Hey, cyclocross friends, and thanks for tuning in to episode 58 of Crosshairs Radio. On today's show, we talk to Lindsay Baer. Lindsay Baer is a, what is she? She's a professional road racer who also owns the, or is a co-owner of the Hagens Berman Supermint Women's Cycling Team. I've known Lindsay for a long time, back when she was racing mountain bikes and also cyclocross bikes. We caught up recently when, on a whim, she jumped into the season finale of the Super 8 cyclocross series in Reston, Virginia, the Capital Cross Classic, and ended up on the podium of our local cyclocross race. And we said, hey, we should get together, record a podcast. So she came over into the basement, and we talked about running a team and racing and starting in mountain biking and cyclocross. And it was a really cool conversation. It's not necessarily all cyclocross, is really more about the road, but I think it's a lot of the same tactics, a lot of the same psychology, a lot of the same issues that we see in cyclocross that also move over to the road, especially in women's racing. And it was a really cool conversation. I was really stoked to have Lindsay over here talking about all things bicycle racing. So, great conversation. We're going to get to that in a second. What do we got coming up? I want to tell you all, or remind you once again, about Nationals in Hartford. If you're going to be up there on January 6th, which is Friday night, Mechanics National Championship at the Black Bear Saloon. Would love to see all of you out there for that. Next night, Saturday night, on January 7th, we're having our Wide Angle Podium Cyclocross Nationals live podcast. That's going to feature Spencer Howell from the Slow Ride Podcast, Adam Meyerson, Emily Kachorik's going to be our special guest in that, and I will be there as well, too. Please come on out for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. On Sunday, we'll have the broadcast. I want you all to tune into the webcast if you're not going to be in Hartford for CX Nationals. I'm going to be part of the broadcast team with Brad Soner and Georgia Gold and Tim Johnson, so that should be a lot of fun as well. A little bit farther down the road, looking at cyclocross worlds, Chicago. I'm going to be in your town in Chicago for cyclocross worlds. We're going to be doing an event at the Rafa Cycle Club. I'm not sure if that's officially announced yet, but I'm unofficially announcing it right here. So come hang out with me Sunday afternoon, January 29th, and we're going to see the race and go through a little analysis and have a lot of fun. So I hope, Chicago, you come out for that. Wideanglepodium.com. Please go there, become a member, subscribe to all the shows, check them all out. There's a lot of great stuff going on there. Kids Don't Follow, we recorded the podcast. We're going to record more. We got a lot of good new tunes to put into your ears while you're training for this upcoming season, or just hanging out on your bike, or just going to work. So yeah, check out all those podcasts, wideanglepodium.com, become a member. If you have not gotten your Skills, Drills, and Belly Aches book, go to cyclocrossbook.com, pick one of those up, or go to Amazon, also on there. And follow me at CXHairs on Instagram, at CXHairs on Twitter. If you got something to say, get at me at feedback@CXHairs.com. If you have a question for me or for the TDDTIE crew, leave us a voicemail, 405-CXHairs. And let's talk to Lindsay Baer. Oh, follow her. Also, follow her team on Instagram, Supermint USA on Twitter and Instagram. Lindsay is at The Dirt Field. And let's get to her conversation right now.
All right, you ready to start?
Yes.
Okay, Lindsay Baer, how's it going?
It's going well, thank you.
Welcome to my basement.
That sounds really creepy.
I know. It's sort of a running theme. Episodes, I have to stress that no one's ever been murdered, as far as I know, in this basement, and we've redone it, so, you know, it's all good.
As long as I put the lotion in the basket, or else I get the hose again.
All right, that's the garage. Let's just keep those two places straight. All right, this is Crosshairs Radio, so cyclocross usually themed, although I've always said that I would like branch out to other things, but I think you fit into that basket. I didn't mean basket. Now you got basket on my bucket. Is that better? Because you raced cyclocross at one point. In fact, you started out on the dirt.
I did. And there was that cross race I did
a few weeks ago. I was going to say. I figured we can, you know, since this is a cyclocross podcast, we can just spend the next 90 minutes talking about your podium, you know, finish at a Cap Cross Classic and your return to cyclocross.
I'll speak really slowly.
But no, let's just for people who may not be familiar with you or your cycling career, let's just start from, well, let's just talk about where you are now, what you do, you know, your position,
your
road
basement.
Racer. Yes, you are in my basement and just, you know.
Yes, now I'm a road racer. So yeah. I started on the dirt, but now I race almost exclusively on the road. I'm racing for a professional women's UCI team that I happen to co-own with my business partner who directs and helps me manage the team. So he runs the actual sporting aspects. I do the behind the scenes. And that is basically my entire cycling career at this point.
Yeah.
I did do a cross race a few weeks ago on the spur.
So what's the team?
The team is Hoggins Berman Supermint. So Hoggins Berman is the title sponsor, law firm based out of Seattle, and then Supermint is the company that John O'Coulter and I started.
Okay, that was going to be a question of mine. So how did the name Supermint? What's that?
So John was Australian, and apparently it's slang in Australian when something is cool to say mint, as in like, oh, mint, or that's mint. And when he and I were planning to start this team, we didn't have a name yet, and at some point, as a joke, we were talking about something being really cool. He's like, that's Supermint. And then it stuck. And we started talking to potential sponsors, and we needed a title to put on the document other than your name goes here, Women's Professional Cycling Team. And so Supermint stuck. And I remember there was one call. I was on the bike, had my headphones in. He's asking me questions about this meeting that we have in 10 minutes with a potential sponsor. And he's like, do we stick with that name? Like, does it sound ridiculous? And I said, well, I mean, yeah, it kind of does, but we've already gone with it, so I guess let's just keep going. And then suddenly we have a team, and it has Supermint in the name, and it's all over shirts and kits. And
I think it's a great name.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. People think it's like gum or Lifesavers,
right,
and they're like, whoa, what is Supermint? Like, it's absolutely nothing at all. It's
imagine. And everything just, at the same time.
It is. We made it up.
That's awesome. All right, and I think we will, you know, get into this as we progress along, but you had retired,
yes,
as a professional bike racer,
yes,
and now unretired.
I haven't decided whether to announce it officially, but
okay,
I'm totally unretired.
Yeah,
so I retired. It was deeply meaningful in October, as a lot of professional cyclists do. They do their big announcement. They're like, "I'm done. It was so great. I really love cycling. It gave me so much." Blah, blah, blah. And then as most professional cyclists do, then I continued training and then racing. And now, you know, I've had some changes in life recently that made me reevaluate why I stepped away from cycling to begin with. And while some of the things that I wanted to step away from are still valid and some of my reasons are still there, I think more than anything, I realize I'm not done. Like, there's still goals I want to accomplish. There's still things I love about racing. And you know, the cyclocross race that I dropped into quite literally made me realize, like, there was a moment in that race where I thought, I feel more like myself doing this ridiculous thing and just smashing my face in, like, over and over again, trying to go as fast as I can. Everything hurts. This feels like what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. And it was fun. And I finished and thought, I hurt. Like, everything felt kind of bad, like, physically, because I was not ready to be racing at that time of year. But every single part of me finished that race and thought, this is what I need to be doing.
Mm.
And so after that, I just got right back into training. And fortunately, a brief retirement is easy to come out of. And so now the only thing I'm really missing is doing the races in Australia with the team that I was going to have done at the beginning of the year. Now my season will start probably, you know, with the American calendar at the beginning of March.
Awesome. I just wanted to get that part out there because I think a lot of people know that you did retire, and I've had podcasts in the past where I've been accused of burying the lead. So I want to mostly, and I'll just mention this, like Gavin Haley, who was this young cyclocross racer, up and coming, you know, was on the world's team, was on podiums, nationals, everything, who has quit and is now a pop star and has like a song on the top 50 and you know.
Well, I tried that.
Yeah.
And I've done some song and dance videos, which you may have seen.
Yeah.
And I don't really think that's in my future. I think I lack the requisite talent.
Well, you know. Yeah, but with him, you know, we went through this whole thing and then we sort of talked about that at the end. So I just want to make sure that, you know, I get all the important information out there first. But now that we've done that.
I mean, I will say, if Sub Pop Records calls me, like,
oh, you're
I'm
there.
Changing my answer.
Heck yeah. I would too. And I'm not even a professional bike racer. So, like, years and years ago when I was announcing, even before I was announcing, but yeah, especially when I was announcing the Greenbrier Challenge, like mountain bike, and you were the esteemed treasurer of the Potomac Velo Club.
Yes. Yeah. Still am.
You still are.
Oh, indeed. Yes, I'm going on, gosh, 9 years now.
Okay. It's
one of my longest term relationships.
And from that time, you know, was, so 9 years ago was about when you probably started?
Yeah. So I started, yeah, they basically coincided. I started riding mountain bikes in 2007 in June, beginning of June, and I was not good at it.
Why? Why?
Why did
Why
I start
Why were
riding?
You riding a mountain bike? Yes.
So I was not fit at all. I was doing nothing. I would sit around and eat. I smoked a little bit. I drank a lot. And one day I decided I should probably start doing some exercise. So I was running. And I was living in Tyson's Corner at the time, which is a business district-ish area for people who don't know this region. And for fun, I was running the stairs in the parking garage near my house, which, as you can imagine, is hideously boring. And one night I came home, I was like, this is terrible. I need to do something else. So I went to Performance and I bought a bicycle the next day. Went to the local park, started riding it. I was really not good at it at all, which really was a recurring theme throughout my mountain biking career. Even when I got better, I still wasn't very good. But within a few weeks, I was there and they were holding mountain bike races in the park. And I thought, huh. So I signed up, did a race. And I remember during the race thinking, this is terrible. Like, why would you ever take something fun?
Where was this? Was this Wakefield?
Wakefield.
Okay, yeah.
Why would you ever take something fun and make it hard and suffering? Like, this feels like work. I'm never doing this again. This is awful. So I finished. And they were like, Lindsay Bayer, you're third in the beginner women.
Yeah.
You're third. And you get a water bottle and a $10 gift certificate. And I mean, I was like, holy crap. I'm like, whoa. I was on the podium. And so I went back the next week and there was this chick who was there and she had long blonde hair and she wore pink body armor. And I remember being like, I've got to beat her. Like that stupid body armor is so lame. How can she beat me? I didn't beat her that week, but I got second and she got first. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to do it again. And the final week I beat her. And I was so excited. I won the beginner women's race at Wakefield and I got another water bottle and another gift certificate. And I did a few more races, and then I used that gift certificate to buy the movie Off-Road to Athens, which was the cycling movie about the mountain bikers competing for the Olympic slots for the 2004 Olympics. And I had no idea that this was an Olympic sport. I mean, a few weeks earlier, I had no idea that you could even race a bike. And after that, I decided, logically, like I'm sure everybody who watches the movie does, I'm going to go to the Olympics. Like, I'm just going to call them and let them know I'm coming. So I contacted Sue Haywood. I was like, can you coach me? And she's like, no, you know, I'm really sorry. I'm not doing any coaching, but you should talk to Allison Dunlap, who was also in the movie. And I mean, exchanging emails with those two women, like I wanted to like cry and pee myself every time because it was so exciting. Like these are celebrities. And so Allison and I started working together that winter. And I went from, hi, I've never ridden a bicycle in my adult life to I'm going to go to the Olympics. And I just have been crazy ever since.
When you're starting this, how old were you when you went?
24 when I really got like crazy about it.
And, yeah.
Like training in my parents' basement, which sounds creepy, but we're in your basement. So I guess this is a recurring theme in my life.
Yeah. So a late start as far as bike racing goes.
Well, I feel like in a lot of sports, and when I meet people outside of cycling, and they know how old I am. Mm-hmm. Like I had dinner with my relatives the other day, and they're like basically implying that I'm ancient at this point. And they're like, how old do women typically do this? I'm like, well, our gold medal Olympian in the last two Olympics from the U.S. is over 40, so right. I feel like I've got some time. But I think for, especially for women, not so much on the men's side, but for women, there is a tendency to come into the sport later. You know, you do have women like Karen Rivera who start very young. Mm-hmm. Skylar Schneider, I mean, amazingly talented. She's been doing this since she was probably 0 years old. But there are women that don't start until their mid-20s.
Yeah.
And then, or even later. And I think, you know, when you come into it as an adult, you've already kind of formed as a person. You've already done the college thing. You've already figured out what you want to do with your life and who you want to be. And then suddenly you find this thing. And I think women who are coming into it later kind of have this maturity that allows them to develop faster as road racers, because there is so much strategy. There is so much like tactical expertise that comes into it. And being able to learn that quickly, have the dedication required to train, to be disciplined, to eat what you need to, do what you need to do, stretch, take care of yourself. Like, it gives you an aptitude that allows you to pick up a sport at the top level and succeed even when you're the ancient age of 32 like me.
So a lot of women also that I speak to that are in a similar situation where they find bike racing not as their first sport, a lot of them are coming at it from another sport. Did you do anything before that?
In high school, I played lacrosse.
Yeah.
I did a little bit of running, but I was always getting injured. There was a time where I dabbled briefly in varsity cheerleading.
Okay.
That was fun. Probably not that helpful now.
Well.
But from when I graduated from high school until 22, 23, yeah, I was a sloth.
Yeah.
I went out. I stayed out way too late. I drank too much. I ate whatever I wanted. I did nothing at all. I was completely sedentary. I remember one time challenging my coworker. He said I couldn't run a mile in 7 minutes. And of course, I'm so egotistical. I'm like, 7 minutes? I can do it in five. I think it took me 20. And I remember wearing like knee socks and something that was not athletic apparel on my feet, because I didn't even have shoes at that point. And I think then I realized I should probably do something more. Just work out.
So since that time, though, I'm sure you've had, like, you know, all the VO2 testing and all that kind of stuff. Like, genetically, do you think you were sort of predisposed to have success in this? I mean, you sort of have to be, right? I mean,
well, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
Like, I would like to think genetically I'm predisposed. I think I have...
I mean, I know that's not to take away. I know that part of your success is that you are a hard worker and also, I mean, stubborn. And when you get out there and can take the pain and all that. And I think that probably has a lot to do with it.
That I think is more of it than anything else.
Yeah.
So I think there are people that are genetically inclined to be good at endurance sports. And I think to some extent, I do have good endurance naturally. Like, I adapted to it quickly. And even when I was a mountain biker, I was always strong. I had no skill or aptitude for the handling part, which is what killed me on trails. Like, I'd get my ass kicked all the time. But road racing, there aren't trees, so that's helpful. But I think there's this quality in certain athletes, in a lot of them, especially at the professional level, that is this stubborn insanity that makes them excellent. So it's like this willingness to continue doing something ridiculously painful over and over again with no regard for how much it sucks. And for me, like, I've always been slightly obsessive compulsive, but this whole, I'll go on what my coach will say, like, do 3 to 4 hours today. And I'm like, well, at this point, she knows me. Like, I don't know why she gives me a range. She knows for me, that means do 4 hours in 1 minute. And if you die at 3 hours and 59 minutes, you have not done the ride. Like, you might as well have not even left the house. And I think that OCD tendency has made me more successful, because even though it makes me crazy and probably makes me in some ways less healthy as an athlete, it also is what has made me successful, because I'll never go halfway. Like, I'll never stop. I'll never, like, if there is a job to be done in a race, or if there's something to be done in training, I will gnaw my own arm off and eat it before not doing as the absolute most that I can. And I think that is what, having that willingness is what makes athletes at the top successful, because they don't stop. Whereas people who are like, ah, that hurts, I'm going to back off, that's where you don't make it that far. You mm-hmm. don't, you're not willing to hurt enough. The people at the top are willing to hurt more than anybody I've ever met.
Yeah.
And that's what makes them good.
Yeah. So when you were racing mountain bikes, and then how did you make your way over, if only briefly for a couple of years there, into cyclocross?
When I was mountain biking, I would do cross in the off season. or what was the off season to me. So I would do a full season of mountain biking from like March or April through, I guess in the US it's about August. And then I would be excited. Like, wow, this is fun. Cause there's not, you don't do as many races when you're mountain biking as you do on
the road. Did you do like nationals when you were mountain biking?
Yeah, never at the professional level. The farthest I got was expert. Okay. But I would go to nationals. I would do the big races. And then, you know, you'd finish the season and be like, I want to keep going.
Yeah.
And basically every year I would start doing cross. And the first year I did a full season. I was on a mountain bike up until the very last race, which was actually the Capital Cross Classic. And I was that, like, I remember I was strong. Like, I was really strong. No skill at all. I remember reading somebody else's blog when I did when Grenogue, is Grenogue still happening?
It is. It came back. Yeah.
Okay. So I did that one and it was a big deal. Like that was a big, big race the year I did it. And I read someone's blog about the race that I was in and they were talking about me and they were like, she was really strong, but she was really terrible. Like truly just painful. Like she would ride the run ups and that was great, but she couldn't like steer to save her life.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I remember reading that and thinking, like, okay, I can take that hit because it's true. Like, I was terrible. Like, I felt terrible for everybody behind me. Not terrible enough to let them pass.
Right.
But still terrible. I won. So I felt like, okay, like, you're welcome to say all the terrible things exactly. you want about me.
Terrible, but winning is not a bad thing.
But I just, you know, so that was a good season. I did a whole run of cross that year. And then in subsequent years, I would start. And usually by the second race, I would be like, no, I'm done for the season. Because I think I was just maybe burned out for every year or something. I was cracking under the pressure. Cause I remember every year without fail, I would end up sitting in my car crying, being like, I don't want to race. Like this feels terrible. And I don't really remember why. I just remember thinking every year I'm going to do this. It's going to be great. And then I would end up in tears and being like, I have to back away. And then after maybe 3 years of that, I decided to stop pretending that I was going to do a full season. Until this year when I actually was like, I'm going to do a full season of cross. And then I didn't.
Well, at least you got one race in.
Yes. And that was a great experience. Yeah. I think, honestly, I am considering doing a season of cross this upcoming fall.
Awesome.
Because, it's crazy fun. Like, it's so...
Yeah.
It's insane. It's ridiculous. Like, the people on the sidelines, you look at them and you're like, you look ridiculous. I feel ridiculous. Like, this is just... The whole thing is ridiculous. Like, why am I carrying my bike? It's like, imagine a horse race where you get off and carry the horse over the steeplechase like barriers. That just sounds ridiculous, but it's fun and it's such a skill. It's like an art form, like practicing the dismount and being smooth, which I don't know if you could see the barriers at Cap Cross, but smooth was not part of the equation. Yeah. I remember people cheered one time because I remounted without doing the extra step. They were like, she got it. And I'm like, let's all remember this because it's not happening again.
Yeah. And that was such a fun race for you too, because it was sort of a homecoming because you know, it's your team. I guess you're still the treasurer. You used to put that race on, so all those guys are still out there. So
I mean, the Mid-Atlantic cycling community is amazing and the people are so supportive. But I've realized traveling around the US and setting up home in multiple places, the cycling community in general, it's kinda like that everywhere. Like they have there are people and you go to events and everybody knows each other and it's sort of like a family reunion everywhere you go where everybody is wearing a leotard.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice.
Yeah.
It's nice like that. I like my leotard. So how do we then get from racing around on the dirt to figuring out that there's road racing out there?
Andrew Steele.
Yeah.
I did it. You owe me $5.
I'll have to mark the time for him.
Yeah, so in, I guess that was 2011. He was just a roadie. I mean, he did a little bit of mountain biking, but I was just a mountain biker, and we lived in adjacent neighborhoods. So we started riding together, training together a bit, and one day in March, my mountain bike race was rained out. So it was like the day before and I got word, your race is canceled. And he's like, I'm going to the Sleepy Hole Smackdown. God, that name. And I'm like, okay, that sounds cool. He said, you know, you can come. And because you are a category one mountain bike racer, you can basically do any category you want for road racing. So I'm like, this sounds great. The Cat 4 women's race was at like 8 o'clock in the morning, and this place was 4 hours away.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Cat 4 men's race was at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. much more palatable. And Andrew was doing that race. So I'm like, okay, I'll do your race. And I guess it never occurred to him to ask, have you ever ridden in a group?
Outstanding.
So he didn't ask, and I didn't know to say, I've never ridden in a group. I'm riding a cross bike with slick tires that I've ridden maybe 10 times. So we go to the race. We stand at the start. They blow the whistle. And I'm like, why is nobody sprinting? Because in mountain bike racing and cross, the hole shot's everything. So I'm like, I'm going to get the hole shot. And nobody else gives a shit. Like everyone, they blow the whistle. And I feel like some people are still putting on their shoes. So then we start riding laps around what is basically a parking lot-ish. Like, I don't even know what the course was. It was just a rectangle around a field or something. And I just could not figure out what was going on. Like, had no idea. Like, people would ride past me really fast. And I'd be like, where are you going? Like, what is happening? And then other people would be sitting behind me while I'm, like, trying to close gaps. But I couldn't get what was going on. There were points where I'd look up the road and be like, oh, I see Andrew. They're like, hi. And meanwhile, there's people sitting, like, right behind me. Like, so this drafting concept, the Peloton, all that was just lost on me. No idea.
Especially in a Cat 4 race when, for a lot of those guys, it was lost on them, too.
Yeah.
So then you had some people who knew what was going on and then just sort of chaos as well.
So there's one moment where I'm like, I'm feeling pretty good and Andrew's right there and I don't want to look bad in front of him. I want to look like I'm capable. So I'm going to go up there. So I pedal a little bit harder and I'm just slotting in to right behind him when there is a catastrophic crash as the guy next to him comes over. We touch wheels and there's lots of body parts flying in the air, all of them mine. And it was a bad crash, very bad. So they have to stop the race to, like, immobilize me, take me away in an ambulance. That was my first road race. Yes, it was great. It was real great. I still have very visible scars from that. And after that, I'm like, that didn't go so well. But then people weren't thrilled with that. And understandably so. Like, at the time, I had no idea what I was getting into. But their question in the region was, why was somebody with no experience in a Cat 4 men's race?
Mm.
And like the licensing process was such that I was allowed to be there. I didn't know what I didn't know. And so I ended up in this race where really it was sort of, in retrospect, I did not belong there at all. Yeah. Had no experience, didn't know what I was getting into, but I didn't know that going into it. So the backlash was strong. And because of that, I felt like I needed to not just, run away from the whole scene and go back to mountain biking and never revisit road again. And so the following weekend, I started doing more road races in the area, this time in the women's field. And it went well. Like, I really liked it. It was a more natural fit when I was not crashing, than mountain biking. Like, I took to it more naturally. I was never a natural mountain biker. I was always so awkward and gangly and oversteering and overbraking and having to sprint out of every single curve. And road racing just fit. And so after that, I stuck with it and then did a full calendar in 2011, 2012, and then started racing professionally in 2013.
Hmm. So just a couple years in, and then you felt like, and how does that work? I mean, I know you're a driven person, so you were probably pushing to get to that level, but how does one go from just racing up the ranks to then becoming a professional racer?
Well, my advice, especially as a team owner, would be to tell people, go out and do the races you want to race in professionally. At the time when I was new to road racing, I was doing local races and I was being successful, but I was sending my resume out to team managers at professional teams being like, I won the Richmond International Roadway local race. Mm-hmm. And thinking on the other end that they were going to be super excited to get my resume and be like, we got to get this piece. And I'm like, why isn't anybody wanting to hire me? I couldn't understand that. And at the time, I wish someone had explained to me that winning local races does not mean a single thing at the professional level. I was so excited about myself. I remember writing to Rafa and being like, because I had just discovered their awesome apparel, and being like, do you want to sponsor me? And thinking, I mean, this is a given. Like, I just won the Black Hills Road Race. Like, how can you not want to? And when they wrote back, and were like, no, we're good. Thanks. I'm like, what? And then I started racing at the bigger races and realized, like, wow, I am not nearly as good as I liked to think I was. I have a long way to go. And then, from there, I just started racing more and more at those races, tried to learn how to race. Like, so much of it is understanding how the Peloton works, understanding where to put yourself and why and how to be safe and how to work with people in the Peloton how to be safe around, like, as the pieces are moving. And once I started learning that, then I got to know people. I got to meet riders. I got to meet team directors and actually establish some connections that allowed me to then send my resume to somebody who wasn't a complete stranger. And that's really where, like, you get on a team. It's establishing a relationship, making yourself known on and off the bike, and then saying, you know, I'd really love to work for your team. Here's why. Here's what value I can bring to your team. And then from there, you know, I've been racing with teams ever since.
But how hard is that then, coming in almost as a privateer into, I'm assuming, like, these national race calendar races, just and working within, because there's a lot of teamwork in road racing, and you're out there on your own. So, you know, how do you sort of navigate those waters when you're first starting out like that?
When I first started out, it was easy to navigate. I would just ride at the back of the bunch and barely hang on and then finish like 28th and be really excited about that. My first big races were Speed Week. That was when it was still part of the Pro Tour calendar, and like Athens Twilight. I mean, that is an amazing race, but to start as your first national level race, it was terrifying. I was so in over my head. But you know, when you're racing by yourself and trying to get your own results, it's difficult because you're going up against teams that have 6 to 8 riders. They have all the support. But if you think about it, like with a team of 6, if we have 6 riders starting, we're working for one person.
Mm-hmm.
And so ultimately, and at the time I didn't understand how that worked. So I would be riding past. Like, I remember Colavita was the big team in 2011. And in the finish, I would be sprinting past Colavita riders who I was like, why are they not really even pedaling?
Right.
And I'm like, oh, I beat her. Why was she 30th today? Like, wow, I'm really great. And I didn't realize at the time, there's a lot of support riders that do their job and then they're done. So as a privateer, you're almost, you can cross off a lot of those other people.
Yeah, because, as long as you sort of stick in there and hang out with that main group, then at the end, not, you know, they're falling away.
A lot of those riders end up doing their job and then they're done. So eventually it became fairly easy to get like 7th and 8th, because as long as you put yourself in the right position and were strong enough to have a little kick left at the end, once the lead out trains did their job and dropped the riders off, you're not fighting against like 6 riders from UHC. You're fighting against maybe 2.
Mm-hmm.
And they would beat me anyways. But you know, you get an opportunity to put yourself there in the results. And then the other thing that directors look for is what you're doing during the race. And that also comes from within the Peloton. Riders will say like, hey, you know, this one has, like, she's always strong. She's always, like, good to be around. She's a good rider. She's a safe rider. She does aggressive things in the race, but, like, is likable. And that kind of thing, that gets you really far. So doing things like attacking at the right time, you know, working in breakaways with when it's strategic for you, but also strategic to kind of curry favor with the team you're interested in, those kind of things get you noticed and get you opportunities. And a lot of times, it opens the door for guest riding, and guest riding is where you then, like my first race with a professional team, I was a guest rider, and that led to a contract. It wasn't like out of the blue, they called me and said, we want to hire you. And my first 2 years, I kept thinking that that's how it would work. Like, I would just be sitting at Starbucks one day and I'd get a call from Rachel Heal, and she'd be like, oh my gosh, you're amazing. We're going to pay you $50,000 a year. And it doesn't, it just, that's not reality. You have to kind of work your way in and be willing to work for a team as a guest rider and hope for an opportunity from that.
I think also there, you know, talking about starting at the age you did and already being an adult and having like a full-time job on top of racing bikes, that probably just life experience. It was almost, you were used to going out there and finding a job. So you probably approached it differently than somebody who's 19, 20 years old who thinks that they can just, you know, walk onto a team or something.
I mean, my
like
resume and cover letter were perfect, like grammatically, spot on. I used the right like format for everything. The actual things I was saying were so asinine that when I think about them, I hope everybody else has amnesia, because I just remember being really convinced that my decent local race results were going to land me a professional contract. And when I think about that, I think, okay, I see that now. People send me resumes. Well,
that was going to be my next question. Are you more compassionate now when you get those type of inquiries yourself as a team owner?
Yes and no. Like, I will never, the one thing I always do is respond, because the one thing I always respected, like Rachel Heal always responded, always. And I appreciated that so much, because I didn't have to sit and hope, like, maybe they're going to call me. Yeah. No, I knew exactly where I stood. And I feel like just it's a professionalism. Like people want so badly for cycling to be taken seriously and for it to be a business and for us to have the infrastructure that other sports that call themselves professional have. But it starts with the people in it. So something as basic as if you get a resume, you freaking respond. That's not hard. You send an email. It's not that hard to send a polite rejection that takes two sentences, but it means a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I always respond. There's times where I want to offer advice, but I feel like it's not my place. If you send me your resume, I will, you know, Jono and I will look at it, consider it. He will offer, like he has a lot more expertise on the cycling side than I do. So his opinion carries more weight to both of us. But, you know, we'll decide and then we'll respond. But, you know, there's times where I've wanted to say like, please don't send me 7 pages like with like elaborate pictures or paragraphs upon paragraphs of your life story. But I see like there people make the same mistakes I did. So I get it. Like I get when your results, when you're really proud of your results and you're really excited about your career, it feels like a big deal to have come in third at that local race.
Right.
Like for me, I felt like it meant something and it did. It just, unfortunately, there's a lot of women and men who have great local results and you have to take it a step further to really put yourself out there and be considered and actually have a chance of getting that job.
Yeah. Yeah. I always look at it, you know, and I was not by any stretch of the imagination an amazing basketball player, but I was like all conference in, you know, Richmond. But then you look at it and every city has an all conference. So trying to go to college and get a scholarship and that kind of thing, you're going up against thousands and thousands of people who are all conference, who are all, you know, getting third in that local race. So that's what I don't think people take into consideration is just how many people are doing just as well as they are across the country. And it's a big country.
And it's a matter of perspective. When your whole world is local racing and you're dominating, you feel great. You don't realize on the grander scale when you go to national or international racing, you're going to get trampled. Like I got trampled for probably my first year and a half of racing nationally. Like I didn't have the skills. I didn't have the experience. I didn't have the comfort in the peloton to even hold my position in the top 15 riders in the bunch. It takes time. And the best way to get that experience is to just go there. Go to the races, try it out. Yes, it's expensive. Yes, it takes time and effort. Yes, it sucks to have to fly with your bike and pay for it out of pocket. But that's what you need to do to get to the level that you want to be at. And then establishing relationships. Like it's a small, small, small world. If you don't know anyone in the peloton, if you don't introduce yourself, if you don't show that you're pleasant and not terribly crazy, because we're all crazy, but not terribly crazy, you know, you're not going to get anywhere. Because really, I feel like the resume is a formality. For the most part, like the riders we hired this year, we didn't hire because they dropped into our inbox and we're like, oh, have you heard of so-and-so? No, but this resume is great. Like, it's a small world. You know, we all know the races. We know, I mean, I imagine it's exactly the same in cyclocross. There's not a dark horse that's going to show up next, like at nationals and win. You're like, oh my gosh, this person never raced before. Like, never heard of him. You know who's who. And so, you know, when someone who is established as an experienced either teammate or like star rider, you know, if you get word they're looking for a team, you don't need a resume. Like I didn't need a resume to see like, oh, Jess Sarah is an amazing rider. We just knew she was awesome and wanted to hire her. Whereas, you know, for new riders, you can send your resume, but if you haven't established kind of an in, made a point to introduce yourself, say like, I'm so-and-so, you know, I'd really love to ride for your team. Like kind of establish a rapport with some of the existing riders so that they look out for you and see, oh, that is someone I'd like to ride with. It's not really going to get you anywhere.
So as far as, and I want to get back to you moving up from there, but I just have this question about guest riding. As a team owner yourself, will you accept guest riders? And what's the incentive? What is that for? Is that looking at somebody? Is it another established pro that's just in a situation where they want to ride? Or what? How does
it can be any number of things.
Work?
So, I mean, you have early on in the year, like we have 11 riders on our roster now. And most national and international races, you're allowed to have 6 to 8 at most. So we have a full squad. We're not hurting for starters for any event. By the time you get to May and June, usually it's actually you start to run into like not necessarily having a full squad for every event because people are tired. They're in the point where they're like in an off-season mode trying to get ready for the second half of the season. They're injured. They can't travel. They need to be working. There's something. And so at that point, that's when you start taking on guest riders. And it could be anything from, you know, somebody left their team and they're looking to continue racing and they're a talented rider and we want them on the squad for results. Or it could be like we picked up Iri Yanomine this past season. I think right after Redlands, she had an amazing ride there. She came over from Japan. She was crushing it. Like, we're all like, who is this person? We've never seen her before. Well, she was an international rider. She came here. She wanted to spend some more time in the U.S. And so we signed her in April, May. And she spent the rest of the summer racing with us. And in that case, it was just, you know, she wasn't an American rider. She hadn't been here. She wasn't on our radar, but she suddenly came over here and was looking to race. Towards the end of the year, sometimes it's a trial run. So teams will say, you know, we have spots on the roster available for this event. Like, we're kind of interested in you. Let's give it a go. Like, that's my first opportunity was with Colavita. They were doing a crit.
Yeah.
They really didn't have anybody they wanted to, like, had available to send. They didn't really want to put money towards it, but I was willing to go pay my own way, wear their kit, race for them, and just show what I was able to do and hope that it led to something.
And did it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was basically an audition, and I got the part.
Yeah. So was that, and that's the first, was that your first pro contract then?
Yeah. So that was, that race was the Boston Crit, which is typically the absolute last race of the American road calendar. So it was September, like late September in 2012, I went and did Boston. I raced for Colavita there. And after the race was done, Iona Winter Parks, who was directing at the time, she said, you know, this was great. You know, we loved working with you here. You weren't totally crazy, just a little. So we'd like to offer you a job.
So first pro cycling job just over 4 years ago.
Gosh, yeah, that was a long time. Indeed, yes.
And what's the progression from just getting that first opportunity?
Well, so if you'd asked me 2 years ago, like, do you think you ever want to own a women's professional cycling team? I'd be like, hell no. Like, I can't think of anything that sounds worse. And yet somehow here I am. So, you know, I raced with Colavita. I did, you know, a full season there and it was hard. Like, you go from being a local star, people are like, you're so great, to being an absolute nobody. Like, you're wearing a pro team kit and that feels so cool. You feel amazing. You walk around the races looking at the other people who are not in pro team kits and forgetting that 5 minutes ago you were them. Instead, you look at them like, I am so much better than you. And yet I finished every race like 50th because I was working and also I was really inexperienced. So my parents would call afterwards and be like, well, maybe if you, like, Laura Van Gilder doesn't spend as much time on the front. Like, maybe you should try that. I'm like, thanks, Mom. But, you know, it's a combination of you're the new person on a team. You're a worker plus you're inexperienced. And so you're just, you know, I was struggling. But
and,
I did.
And because it's so different than cyclocross, and I know a lot of people out there follow road, so they sort of know this, but just from the inside, when you say you're a worker and you have a job to do, I mean, how strict is that, and when does that happen, and when do you sort of get your marching orders, and how closely is that all, you know, calculated and watched and everything?
So every race for every pro team, like right before the race, every team has a meeting. So you see, like, if you walk around the venue, you see everyone sitting in chairs in a circle for every team. So you have a meeting, and the director says, this is what we're going to do. And the meeting will say, you know, here's the plan. Here's, like, the contingency plan. You know, here's your job, your job, your job. Everyone has a job. And it might be somewhat flexible. Like, I had some races where my job was to go for it and see what I could do. Mm-hmm. And I usually stuffed those up the worst. But, you know, sometimes my job would be, you know, you need to, at two laps to go, get on the front and just drive it for as long and hard as you can, in theory, hopefully one lap. And so this is for crits. And then, you know, that was my job. And I loved that because it was a clear task. Like, okay, that's what I have to do. Like, I don't care what it takes. If I have to run over my own mother to get to the front at two laps to go, like, that's going to happen. And so I would do that. And I would do that. And then when you're done, like, you've spent every last bit of your energy and you're just dead. So I would finish. Like, there'd be a lot of crits where, instead of even doing the last lap, I would jump off the course and go watch the finish so I could see how my team did, because it's like, you worked for that.
That's, yeah.
That matters more than, like, finishing 50th. That's irrelevant. And then little by little, you know, you move up, you know, you hopefully get
That's what I always find fascinating about amateur road racing, especially crit racing versus pro, where that's your job. That's how you're, you know, going to be asked to be on this team again and get paid to do it. Where amateur teams that somehow are asking their friends to do that for them and then not get results, I always find it takes a special person to want to play that role. And I guess some do, but it's definitely different as opposed
it's fun.
To like.
Like no. I've been a domestique. Even this past year, I was a domestique quite often. And I just like it because you get more opportunities during the race to do stuff.
Yeah.
If you're not saving yourself for the finish, you can be that person that chases down 5 breakaways, launches a few attacks, goes back to the team car for water bottles. Like, you're really a lot more active. And for me, it's more engaging and entertaining. And I like feeling like I have completely emptied every last ounce of strength I have to accomplish a team goal. And, you know, when you're working for a sprinter that you believe in, it's cool to be like, okay, I'm going to get on the front and I'm going to go until I physically can't go anymore. And then I'm just going to tuck as small as I can, wait for the field to go by, and then I'm done.
Yeah. I guess it's also a commodity then. If you're good at that, then that's what teams are looking for.
And like, as a team manager, I do look for that. Like, I chose a couple of riders specifically because they are absolutely tireless, selfless, diehard, go for the team goal only kind of riders. And that, I feel like, to me, that's almost more respectable than being someone who gets the results. Because while the results require finesse and skill and strength and being good under pressure, a selfless domestique, like, that's invaluable. Mm-hmm. Knowing that in a pinch, you can count on somebody. Like, my team has, in my experience, we have more of those than I've ridden with in the past. Like, we currently have more totally selfless riders than I've ever been with. And it's cool to think, no matter what, like, these people will give it up for somebody else.
Yeah.
And when given an opportunity to shine on their own, like, I can't even wait to see what they're going to do. But that selfless quality, like, that makes for an amazing teammate. And it's a lot more fun to ride with people like that.
Hmm. So from Colavito, what's the next step? And also in there, you know, I'm always interested in the economics of this. Do you get a point where you can live off of what you're making as a cyclist, a professional cyclist?
Absolutely. If you live in a refrigerator box under an overpass by the freeway.
Yeah.
Near a soup kitchen. Then yes. And you don't eat a lot. Yes. In women's professional cycling in the US and probably internationally even, no, hell no. And that's an unfortunate reality of the sport.
Well, I think definitely international. We talk about that with cyclocross a lot, and especially with some of the Belgian teams that are, you know, notorious as like the biggest sport in the country, yet the women are hardly paid at all and just sort of getting kits and bikes and stuff.
Yeah. In the US, it's actually not that common even for professional riders to be paid. We made it a point when we started this team that all of our riders get salaries, because it mattered as a sign of respect. Like, we're calling you a professional cyclist. We need to compensate you, even if it's small. I'm going to give you as much as I possibly can, but it is my way of saying I respect that you do this professionally and it's worth something. It's just a small pie to work from, but yeah, nobody's living off of it.
Yeah. And that's something too that I am in the camp that still makes you a professional. There are some people out there who are like, well, if you can't live off of it, you're not actually professional, which I never really agreed with. I mean, you've reached that level where somebody wants to pay you for your services. You know,
everybody seems to have their own definition of professional. I've heard things like, if you don't ride for a UCI team, you're not professional. Mm. If your license doesn't say pro, you're not professional. If you don't get paid, if you can't like ride your bike backwards with no hands while yodeling and juggling, you're not professional. I think it's almost an irrelevant definition. It's just, for me, it's like I devote most of my time and effort to this, even though I work other jobs outside of cycling.
Right.
This is what I do. And I consider myself a professional cyclist because this is what I do. And the riders on my team, most of them have jobs outside of cycling, but cycling is their primary discipline. It's what they do. It's where they put all of their time and effort, and they also get paid. So I guess. You know, I would, and we're UCI. So I would definitely say, you know, I think if you get paid, you can call yourself professional, even if it's like $20 a year, because hell, you're getting paid to ride your bike.
Exactly.
It's pretty cool.
Exactly. Yeah. Now I see that. It's funny too, because even doing this kind of stuff, I get people with that. It's like, oh, it's a nice hobby that you have. I'm like, yeah, a hobby. This is a job. I have another job that pays most of my bills, but this is a job as well. So I sort of see that, you know, sort of the same deal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cola Vita, where after that?
I was on Cola Vita for a season and a half, and then I went to Pepper Palace,
mm-hmm.
which they were a UCI team that no longer exists. I think they have an amateur team now. And then from there, I did the World Championship team time trial with BMW Happy Tooth. And that's where I met Jono. I mean, I'd known Jono all along. He rejected me quite a few times prior to finally letting me come on board.
As long as you own the team.
So I rode, I worked with him, and we did the TTT at Worlds in Richmond, which was
amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Experience wise.
Yeah, that was really cool. That was really cool.
Which was under a 2-hour drive from, you know.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah.
If I'd really been committed, I could have ridden my bike from home. But yeah, one of my goals has always been to race at Worlds.
Mm.
I don't really feel like I've checked that off yet. I think starting and finishing the Triple T does not quite count for what I wanted to do. Like, I'd like to actually contest Worlds at some point. But it was an amazing experience, and it was so cool to be there. And actually, you know, we only had 5 riders most of the teams, and you were allowed to have 6.
Mm.
So that put us at a bit of a disadvantage. Yeah. But, you know, we went out there. We did our best. It was really cool to just be part of that. And then Jono and I started talking and having phone conversations, suddenly turned into having a team.
How does that even... You're riding for this other team, and then obviously something, you were looking for something more, or things weren't going, or this team wasn't.
So BMW Happy Tooth was part of that whole Smart Stop empire, and that had already crumbled.
Okay.
So that was crumbling. So there was nothing left in terms of that team.
Right.
So Jono and I were both working for a team that no longer existed, in essence. And we spent, you know, we were hanging out at Worlds, like the race happened, and then we're still a little bit more hanging out. And we're talking, and I'd be like, Jono, what are you going to do for next year? Because I really loved working with him, and I figured he always lands somewhere on his feet. And so I thought, I'll just hang out with this dude. Like, I'm going to end up somewhere. This is going to be great. So we were talking, and I would check in with him, be like, hey, like, what are you? And he'd be like, well, I've got this kind of in the works and this. And like a few days ago, I'd be like, hey, what's going on? You got a team? Because I got a resume. I can send it to you. And suddenly that conversation sort of transitioned into, like, we were kind of talking about it together. It went from me asking him to him being like, well, I've got this. And I was like, well, let me try and help with this part, and I can do this. And, you know, professionally outside of cycling, my background is marketing and proposal management. So I do proposals. So I was like, well, I can kind of take some of those skills and stick them into the cycling world and kind of help you with this. And then I don't really know how we went from that conversation to suddenly we're pitching sponsors together.
Mm.
But it was like, I mean, I loved working with him. He's crazy. I could barely understand what he was saying half the time because he speaks Australian. And suddenly I'm like, I think we're building a team. Like, what? There's not enough alcohol in the world for this. So we're going forward, and then we're in it together. And there'd be times last fall where he and I would be, I mean, we'd be on the phone like 8 times a day. I felt like we were married, like just the crazy amount of phone calls going back and forth. And there'd be times where he'd be like, this is nuts. Like, I don't know about this. And I'd be like, no, this is going to be great. And there'd be times where I would tell him, this is nuts. I don't know about this. And he'd be like, no, this is going to be great. And the two of us just, we carried each other through. And it was some of the hardest months of work because, I mean, the sheer amount of rejection, like trying to find a sponsor for women's professional cycling team. That is just a difficult proposition. It's a very hard business pitch. It's not, you know, there's not a lot of data available from a business perspective to really sell it. So you have to find somebody who's passionate enough about the sport. And that was a lot of work. But suddenly we had Hagens Berman. And that was amazing. Like, Steve Berman just made my world. And he knew it. Like, he emails me back when we finally connected and he said, yes, he's on board. And he's like, did I make your day? I'm like, I'm literally weeping. I'm like, yeah, I'm all right. Thank you. But from there, you know, once we had a title sponsor, then I felt like I owed it to the riders that we'd brought on, the sponsors we were bringing on, Hoggins Berman, to really make certain we had our shit dialed. And so from there, it was just get all the licenses, get everything squared away, get the kits designed, get everything so that we looked good, we sounded good, we were prepared, get team camp squared away, and start a season.
And it, I mean, I think you've done a great job in that for a new team and for a team that's just sort of up and coming, you definitely see you all out there. And, you know, then the different cycling publications are always, you're always listed in there. So I think the marketing has worked.
Yeah, we had a really good first season. I'm very happy with how it went. I think, you know, there's opportunities to do even better in 2017, both on and off the bike. You know, because my background is marketing, I'm very particular about how we approach things. And I think it's important. Like, there's so much dialogue about treating cycling like a business and women cycling, how to get more money and how to get more infrastructure and how to have it be more successful. But people don't approach it from a business perspective often enough. Like, where's the value proposition? Right. I get that you want more money, but if you don't give me a reason, it's hard to sell. So you have to really work from that angle. Like, if you're approaching business people, if you're asking people to hand over money, you got to make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
And so my goal in building this team has always been to treat it like a professional organization and to have what we do for our sponsors and how we present ourselves to be as professional as possible. So going into 2017, I think there's even more we can do from a marketing side to bring value to the sponsors, show them that their investment in our team is worthwhile, that they are getting things out of it that they can then take to market and bring in more customers that realize profits for them, that, you know, our riders are happy, that our staff is happy, that, you know, Hoggins Berman feels like it's a worthwhile investment and that they're supporting a successful organization that is progressing towards even bigger things in the future.
Yeah, and that's the important part of it. And I think you're right. It's like, it's not, you know, and there's a lot of talk about that with sponsorship and everything out where it can't be a handout, that the team has to have a value add for why they're out there. And even in women's racing on a bigger spectrum, and that's was always the argument, like for cyclocross, for instance, that the women got paid less, prize money was less, and it was always like, well, the sponsorship's not there. And then you look at European cyclocross, they started putting it on TV. It's more compelling. It's more the women are more exciting races, and they're looking at the TV numbers, and they're getting hundreds of thousands of viewers, you know, moving up towards where the men are. So, and now you're like, okay, well, sponsors, that's something that you can show a sponsor and say, hey, here's something that you should be paying for, and you'll get your money back from that. And I think it's the same thing. I think that's what you all do a good job in, and you have riders who are willing to put themselves out there and be people, which is really important, especially for bike racers who sometimes can get into their little shells.
That's the value of women cycling versus men's.
Yeah.
Is because the women tend to be older, they come into it later. They generally have established careers because they need the careers to support themselves because cycling isn't paying enough. There's a lot more stories there. Like, if you look at the women's professional peloton, you have women that are doctors, that are lawyers, architects, scientists, PhD students. You look at the men's professional peloton and you have really strong bike racers who tend to be a lot younger. A lot of them haven't finished college or gone at all. Like, they just, it's a different experience. And so I think from our perspective, like, one of the most popular photos we have from a race this year is after Scotty won the first stage at Redlands and got the yellow jersey, but it's right at the finish. She is still straddling her bike, standing there, and her two kids are hugging her. She has twin boys. And just that story, like, this woman just, like, dominated this race, won a professional national level event, and has two kids that travel with her and live on the road with her. And it's just that's an amazing story that for a lot of fans in cycling, they see that, and it's more relatable. It's more interesting than, you know, a 19-year-old kid won a race.
Who wants to buy a big watch.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that's where, as a team, I wanted to make certain that we featured those stories because I found that was more interesting to sponsors and people outside of the professional cycling business. And going into 2017, I think we're going to do more of that. There wasn't as much as I wanted this year. And it's hard because I was, you know, managing a team while trying to race and work outside of cycling. There were times where I think I was stretched too thin and I didn't do what I wanted to be doing. I didn't quite do as much as I felt like I should have been.
Mm-hmm.
And
but now you're retired, so it's.
Oh yeah.
Oh wait.
Well, I mean, it was a really, it was a very refreshing 5 weeks of retirement in which I did great things, and then yeah. So I think this season, obviously, I still have just as much on my plate, but now, you know, I've taken back control of doing the marketing side of the team. You know, we'd brought in someone this past year to take care of that, and. You know, there were really good things that came out of that. There were things that also came out of it that I think we can improve upon. And my goal for 2017 is to really deliver to our sponsors because we have wonderful sponsors. Like it's hard. It's a hard sell to say, come on board to support a women's professional team. And for the companies that have, my number one goal is to make them come out of the season and think like, that was great. We got a lot out of that. We love it. So there's nothing that makes me happier right now than seeing Honey Stinger post one of our photos on their feeds or Fast Forward Wheels or HIA. Like when those companies clearly see value from what we're doing, that to me is success just as much as getting on the podium because a podium is great. But if industry sponsors can't sell anything with it, then it's not valuable to them and they're not going to keep their business and their money and their attention on the sport and women cycling, and then it's not that useful.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I think the podium, you know, it's great to win, but the podium is probably the most boring, you know, shot you're going to get out there.
Yeah.
But speaking of compelling shots from 2016, you have one of the most famous that's out there. You're up for like photography awards.
Are you talking about the Gastown one?
Uh-huh.
So funny thing about that. So
To describe the photo, if you all haven't seen it, it's Lindsay, she can explain it, who has crashed and is in focus. And
it's like roadkill.
Yeah, and then just the blur of the Peloton going through this turn around her. And it's
an amazing photo.
Yeah.
So the first time I saw it, somebody sent it to me. A teammate sent it to me. And I was like, oh, crap. That's a really good photo of a really embarrassing moment. So
well, the other thing that we should mention, it's a bird's eye view. So it was somebody who was on top of a building or something looking down. So you see this sort of top down.
I mean, it's an amazing photo.
Lying in a fetal position in the middle of the road with hundreds of bikers, cyclists.
When you say it that way, it sounds really sad. So I'm in this race and a girl goes off the front and I jump to follow her and it's right at the hairpin. And yeah, I didn't do it right. So when I hit that hairpin, I slid out and I was at the very front of the group. So I was very, very, very lucky that I did not take anyone else out. It was just, you know, I made a mistake and I ended up, you know, because I knew I was on the ground in front of an oncoming Peloton, my first instinct was to go in the fetal position and wait for everyone to pass. And then everyone passes, and all the people are staring at me from behind the fences, and I'm stuck to my bike. I'm like, can somebody help me? And everyone's just staring. And I'm like, this is great. So, yeah, I got up, got back in the race at the end. But when that photo came out, I was like, oh, that's a really nice photo of a terrible moment that I would prefer not to remember. And then it started to get real popular.
Yeah.
Real popular. Yeah. And then it was on the cover of Cycling Tips. And I'm like, you can be embarrassed about it and hate your life and be like, oh, that's so terrible. Or you can just embrace it because honestly, it is beautiful artwork.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yes, I crashed my bike. Everybody has crashed. It
and you
happens.
Did what you wanted to do. And yeah, you crashed.
And it was like, is it embarrassing? I guess. But I'm not embarrassed anymore. Like, it's a great photo. And it's funny. Like, I look at that. And for me, I remember the race where I crashed. And then I got back up and got in the race and finished. And like that, you know, everybody crashes. At least this one made a beautiful piece of art. So when
I think it was up for like Cycling Tips again, had it as one of their, I don't know if they're voting on it for best photo of the year or in that.
I did see, I saw that contest.
Yeah.
I saw it a few weeks ago when it first came out and I saw some of the people that had entered that contest and I figured I know a really good photo that should be entered in this contest. And yes, I look like a complete ass. I literally look like a squirrel that has been mowed down. But I'm willing to take that bullet if it means that a truly good photo gets submitted in this contest. So I contacted the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
I emailed him and said, hey, Stefan. I don't remember his last name. I should because the photo is amazing. But I was like, hey, Stefan, here's the link to this contest. You should enter that photo. I think it's a great idea. And, you know, I'm willing to look like an idiot in front of the entire world if it means you get to win that contest. And lo and behold, he did submit it. I was very happy about that. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's, We'll try to post that again.
I mean, it's a great, it is truly, you know, I had different reasons for wanting him to enter it in that contest, but mostly it's an amazing photo of an incredible moment in cycling because everybody crashes, but to have this moment where you see one rider down and the entire peloton is this rainbow of different jerseys and helmets and bikes, and they're in the middle of a city because Gastown is like an iconic historic town. To have that moment in this hairpin turn, it was really cool. I think it's up there with some of the other really cool like photos that have been submitted in that contest. There was one of that guy like ricocheting off a wall. That was that was pretty cool.
So this may be a weird turn, but it was just in separate conversations that you and I have had, some of the things that, you know, we've sort of talked about a little bit that I think affect psychology of racing, but also sort of the maybe not so great effects of racing, which I kind of like to touch on some when I'm talking to folks. And I know you've mentioned like eating and diet and stuff around that. And I don't know if that's something that you want to talk about and I think it affects men and women, but I feel like at least from what you've indicated, it's something that you've struggled with.
Oh, absolutely. I think in cycling, there's just, I mean, the very basic principle of watts per kilogram, that concept immediately drives everyone to reconsider every single kilogram they're carrying because watts are difficult to increase. Kilograms are easier to decrease. And so as a cyclist, you immediately start thinking, how can I get faster? Like you're willing to swap out parts on your bike for great sums of money to try and get lighter parts. But then you start thinking, well, what if my parts were lighter? And it's natural to start examining that. And then you get around other cyclists and there's this culture of being thinner. That's the basic way to put it. Like everybody is focused for the most part on being thinner. People make jokes, people make lighthearted comments. You know, I used to go to parties like years ago and I would be eating cake at a holiday party with other cyclists and people would be like, oh, you must be in your off season. I'm like, why? Because I'm eating a freaking piece of cake. Like, what am I not allowed to eat? But it's just the culture. Like we perpetuate this assumption that thinner is better. And it's so difficult to get that out of your head because you look at certain riders and think, well, they're thinner than me and they're going uphill faster. And clearly I would be better if I was also thinner. And then especially at the professional level, it's the proximity. You're with all these people all the time who do the same thing as you. And most of them are basically as good. And so you look for every advantage you can get. And outside of the races, you're with your teammates all the time. And someone's like, well, I don't eat gluten and I don't eat soy and I don't eat dairy and I don't eat food and I only eat air. And the next thing you know, you're looking at your own food and thinking, oh, I eat so much and I should be, you know, if your teammate only eats half her dinner and you're eating your whole thing, like sometimes there's this feeling of, oh, they're doing better. And you just get caught up in this cycle of always thinking that thinner would be better. And it starts to change how you think and look at yourself. And when you dedicate your entire life to being faster and stronger, it starts to get difficult to figure out where the line is. Like where do you stop trying to be better? Like where do you... So for me, you know, my first 6 years, 7 years, 5 years, like I was normal crazy. Like I would watch what I ate and I ate more and more vegetables and I stopped drinking any sodas and I would try not to eat 7 pieces of cake in one sitting, but I still was fairly normal. And then there came a point where I remember going to Interbike and doing the crit in Vegas. And I just, that whole weekend, I just ate too much and drank too much. And I went to Boston and it was the end of the season and we partied with the whole team. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm like, I feel kind of bad about myself. And now it's the off season and that's even... like, I'm not even racing anymore, so I should probably get leaner. And that's kind of when things got out of control for me. Like, I started, at first I just started not eating enough, and then I was bonking on every ride, and then I would overeat because I was just cracked. Like, I was starving, and then I started throwing up. Like, at first, if you had told me 5 years ago, oh, you're going to be a bulimic, I would have laughed because I thought that was so, like, who would do that? How do you even do that? It's not even imaginable, but then I became a bulimic and it got easier. Like the more I did it, it became like, as soon as I would overeat, I would just think, oh, well, that's a good solution. Like I can just undo it. Like It's like when you have a typo on your computer, you just hit Control Z and it's gone. And so food was the same way. So then it started to think, like, it was around the holidays and I would just eat whatever because I would think I can get rid of it. And then I would. And that continued. And it just, it totally killed that whole off season because I was training without enough fuel. By the time I hit the actual season, I had no base. Like, I was weak. I was strong enough to hang in the races and keep getting rostered, but I was an emotional mess. I was exhausted. I was not healthy. I was depressed. And eventually, I almost quit racing, and that's when I left Coal Vita, and just, I was just, I kind of was flaming out pretty hard, but then I was able to get things under control enough and came back to racing. It was healthy, relatively speaking, but still bulimic intermittently. And that continued basically up until last fall. This fall, I guess it still is. No, it's winter now. So last fall. And for me, it was never like a persistent, like it wasn't happening that often, but it was happening enough that people were like, you're not well, like that's not healthy. That's not normal. But unfortunately, the culture in cycling is that it's almost normal.
So is this, you're not alone in that?
Oh, not at all. Like, the crazy thing to me is how many people, when I would talk about it, would be like, yeah, I'm either anorexic or I'm bulimic or I was bulimic or I did this or I did that. I would say the majority of the people I've ridden with or spoken to have had actual clinical eating disorders that have in some way impacted their life and made it so that at some point or another they were controlled by it. And I think the weird thing to me is that people don't talk about it. Like, from the beginning, there were maybe 3 or 4 weeks before I started talking about it, where it was happening. I didn't really know how to say anything because it's awkward. Like, hey, I like to binge eat and throw up my food. Like, that's a conversation stopper. But I put a post on my blog about it, and the outpouring of support was astonishing. Like, I didn't know how it would be received. I thought, especially as a rider on contract, I thought, this is suicide. Like, no one's going to hire me because I'm clearly a disaster. But the support was so overwhelming. And so many people came to me and said, I struggle with the same thing and I can't tell anybody. And I thought that must be so isolating because the one thing I have that saves me all the time is a support system. Like, even when I was still engaging in all the behaviors and continuing to be really unhealthy, I still would tell people. Like, I would make myself throw up, and then, you know, my husband would come home and I would say, I did this. And he'd be like, okay, like, we can get through this. Let's, and you know, you would think, why didn't I stop? Why didn't I tell him before? But for me, at least telling him, telling somebody, telling my coach, at least I was staying engaged enough to stay on top of it and not end up in the hospital or dead or unable to ride a bike. And I think more people need to be open about it. And it was weird to me that when I started talking about it, there were so many people that came out of the woodwork and were like, that's my experience too. And I thought if we all were more honest about it and made fewer offhanded comments, like, I still hear things now. People still make jokes now. Like, I went out for a coffee spin with a guy recently and he ate a pastry and made a comment about, like, oh, I'm getting fat. And he's like practically emaciated. And I look at that and think, no wonder we're all so sick. Like, this is the attitude. And the funny thing is I'm looking at him eating the pastry thinking, well, I'm having black coffee, so I'm better than you. And it's like, how screwed up is that? That that's what we do. And when you look at the people that are successful in the sport, Mara Abbott is the best climber for sure. And has admitted to having serious eating issues. And you know, I don't know her personally, but you know, she's been very honest about having those struggles. And that's, you know, that's definitely difficult to watch. But there's a lot of women who can totally kick my ass up a mountain that are not tiny at all. And I look at that and think, why can't I internalize that and be kinder to myself, be healthier, not feel guilty about eating like an extra piece of bread? But it's just this environment that we self-perpetuate and then react based on.
So as a team owner, is this something now that, like, when you're having this team camp, is this something that's discussed? Is this something that you're like trying to?
I don't lead with it. Like, hey, welcome to Supermint. How's your eating disorder going? But, you know, I've been very honest with my riders. I was this past year. I said, you know, I've dealt with an eating disorder. I don't think you ever get over it. That's what bothered me about the publications around Mara Abbott's eating disorder was it seemed like when cycling media got a hold of it, they were so quick to talk about how she recovered from it. And I feel like that does a disservice to the person, to her. Because you don't stop thinking those things. You figure out how to be better in control. Like, I don't throw up my food now, but the urge is still there. I still think about it all the time. I still analyze every single calorie that goes in. But, you know, with my riders, like, I wanted them to know it's okay to have that. It's okay to be honest about it. We're not the kind of team that if you show that there are cracks in the facade, we're going to bench you. In fact, I'd rather you be honest. I'd rather you say, I'm struggling with anorexia. I'm burned out. I'm having problems. I'm worried about money and needing to focus on my job outside of cycling. Like, here are the realities of my life, because then we can work with you. I can help you. I can do what I can to support you. I can get you the help you need. I can, you know, send you to races that are a good fit for you and keep you from the ones that are going to do more harm. And I want people to know on my team that it's okay to be human and to be like, that's being a professional athlete. Like, find me one professional athlete that isn't screwed up in some way. But there's teams out there that expect you to be a machine. You show up, you're ready. You don't have outside obligations. You don't have like things that you're thinking about other than the bike. That's not real.
Yeah. Well, it's also, it's always this false equation that being a professional athlete is a healthy lifestyle, where there's not an athlete out there that's not somehow the extreme stress that professional athletes put on their body isn't detrimental.
Yeah, you know,
it's not somebody just going out there and living healthfully. You know,
it's an extreme lifestyle. Because I go back to the office when I'm in the area for work, and people are like, "Oh, you're so healthy." And I'm like, "No, dude, I'm beyond that. Like,
you're in good shape.
Yeah,
you know, you have a good aerobic.
But it's like you're so close to the edge all the time. Like, someone breathes wrong next to you, and you get a cold. You know, one thing goes wrong, and you just crack. Like, I'm with my training, I stay so close to the edge of fatigue that I'm perpetually toppling over the other side of it. And then, you know, I'm constantly trying to find the balance. I mean, even today, it's like a recovery day for me. I did 40 minutes of core and 1 hour of riding, and every single calorie I eat, I think, okay, I can't eat too much because I didn't work out too much today, but yesterday was a big day of riding, and tomorrow is a big day of riding, and every single thing is like this negotiation in my head. And there's this perception. People like to pretend that it's all like, oh, I'm a professional athlete. I have everything together. And I'd much rather people be honest and say, I don't, especially for people like, for people who are not professionals looking into the sport, like women who are getting into cycling, they, you know, we've gone to these events where we talk to people and they say, I could never do that. And I think if you present this image that you're perfect and it's so easy and you train 6 hours a day and you eat nothing but kale smoothies and it's so natural, yeah, of course that seems unattainable. But for me, I'm like, nah, dude, like I rode for an hour today and even that was a chore and I hated it and I still felt stressed about eating like Christmas cookies. That to women has got to be more relatable. And when I say things like, I did a teleconference during my training and I had a milkshake and I felt fat and I stood in front of the mirror and poked at my stomach and worried, like that's something that people can actually connect to. And I think that's also a better way to build a fan base in cycling. Like be relatable. You don't need to be a unicorn and a snowflake. Be somebody that people can think like, I can kind of do that and I'm willing to try. And then you get people who are willing to actually try riding, try training, and they don't think it's so impossible. They don't think that you have to do nothing but drink kale smoothies because they realize, I eat cake, I drink scotch, I make mistakes, I stay up too late. I'm human. I have an eating disorder. Like there's plenty of times that my mom, she's an amazing, wonderful, strong person, beautiful, and she stresses about what she eats all the time. And I look at that and I just want to be like, that's normal. Like that's, I do the same thing. We have that in common. Like I can understand where you're coming from, even though my whole life revolves around my body and you think I'm so fit and in shape. Like, no, I'm pretty flawed. I have the same worries as you do.
Along those same lines, the way that you race, sort of the psychological place that you have to put yourself in. I think about, again, the conversation we had and sort of you going from unretired or retired to unretired and just, you know, what's driving you now. And anger, racing with anger. Is that something that you think is, can carry you
No. No. Okay. God, no. So
that was because it was a conversation we had, and that's what I felt, because that was I've talked to Kristen Keim for Dr. Keim, and she's sort of like, you get one good race on anger.
Yeah.
And after that. So what is it? What is it that is able to keep you in that sort of that place of just being able to hurt yourself and it sort of being okay?
So back when I was living in Seattle and kind of had a different life, I went out for drinks one night with this guy and I didn't know him. And we're sitting there with a group and we're talking. I wasn't in a great mood. It hadn't been a good day. And I'm just engaging in, you know, small talk, banter, whatnot. And we're chatting. And then something about cycling comes up and I start talking. And he looks at me and I'm talking about racing. And he says, that is the first real smile I've seen from you all night. And I could feel it. Like when he said that, I realized, like, I love this crazy, crazy sport. Like, I love it. I don't know why. I absolutely love it. And even when I hate it, even when it's cracking me, even when the racing isn't going well, or I'm tired, or I'm burned out, or the team is exhausting, and I don't feel like running it anymore, I freaking love it. I love it so much. And, you know, in the past 6 months, I got a little sidetracked. Like, there was this plan I had for my life that I kind of developed on the fly based on another person, which, public service announcement, don't do that, everybody. And I think I started to rethink cycling, and other things seemed like, oh, I want to do that. And I wanted to have a kid. In that one, like, I still want to have a kid. I still want to travel the world more than I have so far with cycling. And sometimes I like to travel the world and not try and figure out where I can do intervals in a hotel room in New York City. But, like, I guess I got a little distracted from realizing that the thing I truly loved is this sport. And, like, I have the best family and I have the best friends and these people that make me so happy. But, you know, cycling for some reason is this thing that, like, deep down just works for me. And when I did that cross race, there were moments throughout the race where I finally felt like myself for the first time in months and months and months. And I felt like everything that I'd been trying to do that wasn't coming naturally and was making me unhappy was just gone. And I was on a bike racing and my friends were there and I was having fun and everything hurt and my heart rate was 190 and I thought I was going to die. And I thought, this is great. This is what I love doing. And so when I think about racing and what's motivating and driving me, like, yeah, some bad stuff happened recently and it hurt and it sucked, but I'm not like to think, oh, I'm going to go back and race and, like, channel that. Like, nah, I've got better things to do in the sport. Like, I love it. I was doing CompuTrainer at my coach's studio the other day and it just hurt. And I couldn't stop turning up the watts that she had set for my FTP to make it hurt more. And I felt like I'm smiling, like everything hurts. And I'm not quite nailing the cadence power, like, ratio she was trying to get, but I'm trying really hard and this is fun and I'm happy. I'm happy. And so when I think about racing, like, no part of that is tied to, like, anger or bitterness or thinking about anything other than just, God, this sport is awesome. And when I look at the team that we've put together for this year, like, being at camp and talking to those women and looking at them and thinking, like, I almost walked away from getting to race with these women that I was so excited about another season with. And now the possibility, like, everything that lies ahead in 2017, like, I want to win races for sure. Yeah. I want to win races. Like, I've loved working for a team. I've been a great domestique, but I think it's time that I stop. I think sometimes for me, it's like an escape mechanism. You know, you get to the finish, and if you're the domestique, you get to be done at one to go. If you're the designated person, you are answerable to everybody, and you have to be willing to live up to expectations. And I think it's time that I do that. Because I think more and more often, it got easier to be like, oh, I'm the one that does all the breakaways, and I'm the one that chases things down, and I'm the one that does the great lead out. But I think for me, in a way, I've been afraid to go for it and not, it's easier to, you get so much credit when you're a good domestique. Everyone's like, oh, you were so awesome. You were out there in the front the whole time. The announcer never stopped talking about you. For me, it's scarier to imagine sitting in and waiting and figuring out, how do I win that race? And I think this year is, I'm going to do that instead. Like, I want to work for my team for sure, because there's plenty of races that are just not my style to win. But when the time comes, like, I'm ready to finally step up and let the team help me, and then not disappoint them.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I'm glad that it's our, that was our Super 8 cyclocross race that sort of helped you get there, yeah. Which was hilarious too, because we were just sort of chatting and then you were like...
Well, I remember telling you, like, yeah, these people look insane. Why the hell would you ever want to do this? This looks dumb. And then the next thing I know, I'm like,
well, not even that. You were like, and then you were like volunteering. You were, you know,
manning
a course crossing, sort of, you know, for a little while. And then I see you a half hour later and you've got a borrowed bike and you're searching around for borrowed shoes and pedals. You're like, I'm going to go race. I'm like, okay.
Well, the best thing about manning that course crossing is I'm standing there manning the crossing, feeling very official. It's going really well. And I'm like, people are walking by and I'm trying to look very like authoritative sitting there. And then suddenly somebody asks a question and the guy next to me answers it. And I look at him and he looks at me and I'm like, are you manning this course crossing? He's like, yeah, are you? And I look at him and he looks at me and I'm like, okay, well, I'm out of here. Like, have fun with that.
That's amazing.
But then, yeah, I went from sitting on a log in the woods by a campfire thinking, I'm cold, I definitely don't want to take any of my clothes off, to stripping into my kit in a parking lot and being like, I'm going to race this thing.
And then you were like in the drops for the whole time.
No, not at first. I was on the tops at first because I remember I didn't know if you're supposed to use the drops. So I asked somebody in the race, like I called up to the person ahead of me. I'm like, do you use the drops? And she's like, no. I'm like, oh. Okay, but then there were some of the straight sections where, yeah, I'm in the drops. Like, I'm like, I got to get some advantage.
I just remember you coming back over the dam section. I'm like, roadie.
Oh, yeah.
Well, of course, that's probably where you made up a lot of time.
That was basically the only part I made up time. Everything else is just, the trees and, yeah, that was a struggle. The run-ups were hard.
Yeah. Right. Well, so how much, I mean, I know you talk about core a lot, so how much of that is important, like the off the bike strengthening? Oh, and
God, I'm so, core is like, I mean, it's a running joke with everyone in my life. Like, if I was in the hospital recovering from Ebola and amputation of a major limb, I still would be on the floor doing core. Because it's, for me, it's like my day doesn't get started or isn't complete unless I've done core. And it's kind of like those people that have to lick a doorknob or like touch their nose 48 times. For me, that's core. And it's not, I don't think that's necessarily healthy. It's got, you know, side effects are healthy. It's good. But my first coach had gotten me doing core every day in some capacity. And then my current coach had said, you know, do this routine, cycling specific. So it's motions that are actually beneficial to what you do on the bike. And every day without fail, I get up, I do core. Little by little, the program has grown. Like, I've seen bike fitters and physical therapists who've said, you need to add this, you need to add that. The recurring theme is your butt is weak. So now I do a lot to strengthen that. And yet the recurring theme still is your butt is weak. But yeah, I just flap around on the floor for 40 minutes every day while drinking coffee. And that makes a huge difference.
You're putting that compulsive behavior to good use, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's...
That seems like, I don't know, that seems like a bike racing trait.
Yes, for sure. I mean, you've got to be a bit compulsive to keep up with the insanity that goes with training. And, I mean, looking at most of my teammates, we all have similar quirks and compulsions. And it's like, if you take a bunch of cyclists to the grocery store and send them all out independently, nobody's allowed to speak to one another, and then you get them together at the end, everybody will have all the same crap in their baskets. Like, you got Greek yogurt, you got oats, you got kale, you have eggs, you have seltzer water, you have some kombucha. Like, we're all the same animal, just slightly different variations.
Yeah.
And everybody has their, like, oh, I have to foam roll every day. I have to do core. I have to do this. I have to stretch. We all have our little things that, like, are our rituals that keep us sane. And that's, you know, when you're traveling so much and everything is always changing around you, you're always racing, you're in different places, the scene, the kit, the people change. If you hang on to your routines, like for me, it's core work, it's Cheerios for breakfast, it's coffee every morning. Those things kind of give you a sense of home no matter where you are, and also make you feel like I am in control when you are not.
Nice. All right. Anything else we need to cover?
I don't know. You're running the show here. I'm just trapped in your basement.
it is a nice basement, isn't it? It's nice yellow.
Have you thought about putting some lights in here?
There's like hundreds of lights
there's
in here.
There's no lights at all. It's in the
Oh, come on.
We're in the dark.
You're making that up?
There's a woman screaming in the background.
It's all not true. Awesome. Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
To my murder basement.
It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. And good luck this year.
Thank you. Right. Thank you very much.
All right. And there you have it, Lindsay Bear. Great conversation with her today. Follow her at The Dirt Feel, also at Super Mint USA. Follow me at CX Hairs, and shoot me a note, feedback@cxhairs.com. Get on the helpline, 405-CXHAIRAS. CX 405-CX Hairs. All right. We'll talk to you next time.